And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Marzia Hashimi, thanks so much for being with us. Ceasefires have no meaning, well, at least not for the Israeli regime, which is currently breaking its ceasefire agreements in both Lebanon and Gaza. The bloodletting continues as the Zionist entity extends its killing spree of men, women, and children in both places. Having total impunity, not only does it not try to hide its violations, the regime says it will up the ante against Lebanon, even threatening Beirut if the Lebanese government does not disarm the resistance Hezbollah, and have even warned about the Lebanese army defending liberated areas in the south. What does all of this mean? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this.
It's almost a year now since the ceasefire agreement in Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah went into effect. Yet since then, the regime's violations of the ceasefire have persisted. The Lebanese government recorded at least 3,500 violations and over 100 people killed. The attacks have been mainly on South Lebanon, but other areas like the east have been subjected to Israeli violations as well. While Israel insists that it's targeting Hezbollah infrastructure and personnel, the pictures from the ground tell a different story. A recent Israeli violation involved a strike in the southern region of Nabati.
There are actually 5 martyrs, and we learned from sources these are civilian people that were killed. They were in a civilian car. They were holding their cell phones. So all the claims by the Israelis that there are links directly to Hezbollah is something that is mere fabrications and lies.
But Israel also upped the ante by threatening the entire Arab country as well. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu implied an impending attack if the Lebanese government does not force the disarmament of Hezbollah. And Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Katz vowed to designate the Lebanese capital Beirut as a target. His remarks follow a recent order by Lebanese President Joseph Aoun for the army to protect the south and counter any Israeli incursions. What triggered this order was a blatant Israeli incursion over a kilometer into Lebanese territory, where Israeli occupation forces killed a municipal employee. The attack sparked nationwide outrage in Lebanon. Hezbollah, however, recently reaffirmed its commitment to resistance, stating that it remains the sole path to achieving true strength in the region.
There is a position we must take. This is the position of resistance, of challenge, of confrontation. In the path of resistance, we are not working on a project where we have an occupied land. We try to liberate that land. If it works, then it's good. But if it doesn't work, then we stop. No. This is a struggle and a way of life that is for all of life and not a part of it. This isn't just a project we stop if we don't have certain tactical gains. No, we continue.
The United States has been sitting idly by as Israel violates the ceasefire agreement it mediated, as American envoys come and go, pressuring the Lebanese government to disarm Hezbollah. The people of Lebanon have caught on to the Americans' inaction when it comes to violations against their country, instances of blatant disrespect, and the insistence on weakening their sovereignty through disarmament demands.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ali Riz, security and political analyst out of Beirut. Batu Sobeiti, activist and political analyst out of London. Thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off with Batul in London. It's so dystopian that this regime can openly say that it will attack Beirut and warn the Lebanese president about his army protecting the southern liberated regions of the country. I mean, let's start from here. What do you say to this?
Good evening to you and to your guests and all your viewers. The comprehensive war has ended in the form that it has since the end of the Gaza war and the official ceasefire. So I believe that the stage that we are in West Asia is one of ultimately closing the wars, not starting new ones. So I would categorize the statements being made by the Israelis as mere exaggerations and pressure tactics aimed at the Lebanese government, meant to intimidate Lebanon through threats and political rhetoric. They're essentially trying to achieve what they failed to obtain during the fierce war itself. I mean, for 66 days of the war, they did not succeed in achieving their declared goals of eliminating the resistance, forcing it to hand over its weapons. Assuming they could carry out their threats and launch another war, the question is, will they be able to accomplish what they couldn't in the first one? Because every war has an objective, and if their goal was to destroy the infrastructure, will they fail to do so, even in the most intense stages? So any new war is destined for failure at best. So at the point that the war ends, the short phrase that describes the whole situation in the region right now is incapacity. The incapacity of the Americans and the Israeli occupation entity. And I believe the Americans have reached this conclusion after they opened every door for Israel to achieve the extent that it wanted to reach, even if that meant storming and occupying countries and capitals. We saw nations falling, sovereignty like falling, you know, with Qatar being targeted, and all considerations were cast aside in favor of the entity's security. Okay. You know, what was called the New Middle East or Greater Israel. Everything in the region was handled on that basis, but Israel ultimately failed.
All right. Well, Ali, I mean, Batu's talked about the U.S. basically opening every door to the Israeli regime to reach its goals. I mean, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has warned that the regime will react if Beirut does not disarm Hezbollah. So looking in the context of what our other guest has just said about the U.S. basically letting the regime do whatever it wants, I mean, what do you think this means when he says that they will react to Beirut?
Well, I think that this is still in the realm of a rhetoric escalation, and rhetoric more than really escalation, as in a prelude to a major full-scale war. It's true that Israel has escalated, it's increased its strikes, but it hasn't reached the threshold of full-scale war, and I don't think that we are going to reach that threshold for the time being, as things stand. The U.S. role, which you mentioned, the U.S. envoy, Tom Barak, has made some statements saying that, basically saying that Israel has the right to carry out these strikes in order to disarm Hezbollah, and saying at the same time that Lebanon is a failed state and that it lacks the resources in order to disarm Hezbollah. So you do have a new atmosphere of escalation, but again, will this reach a full-scale war? I think that's yet to be seen. Previously, it's not the first time that Israeli officials have made such threats and escalated their rhetoric. But I think that the Israelis this time, before, if you go back to what happened in last year's war, the full-scale war, the Israelis had a lot more intelligence about Hezbollah. It was a much larger organization than it is today. Of course, we know that it was dealt some serious blows, but at the same time, it doesn't have a lot of intelligence about the newer Hezbollah, which is emerging. So I would be hesitant in jumping to the conclusion that we're on the verge of a full-scale conflict. I might be mistaken. You can't put anything past the Israelis, and I think that the Israelis view this as a golden opportunity. They think that they've dealt some very severe blows to Hezbollah. They want to preserve what they've accomplished, and so they are going to increase the intensity of these strikes. But to go to a full-scale war, I think that even the Trump administration, if you look at what it's doing in the region, I think it's more focused on trying to contain not just Hezbollah, but the axis of resistance more broadly by other means. For example, by enhancing ties with Turkey, Pakistan, all of these countries which the Trump administration views as a kind of a bulwark or as a means to keep Iran and its allies contained.
Okay, well, Batul, how can the Lebanese army really defend the people of that country when it has agreements with the U.S., France, and others from where it gets its military aid, that the army cannot use its weapons against Israel, and that the army must focus on counterterrorism and internal stability, not fighting wars with Israel or domestic groups. I mean, clearly this leaves the Lebanese people unprotected, as Israel is the country's main enemy. Your thoughts?
Yes. The decision to confront Israeli aggression, I believe, is a matter of will before it's a decision of weapons or logistics per se. So if the Lebanese government decides that it does not want to walk with Tom Barak's paper or decision to remove the weapons, it's essentially avoiding the matter, or it's prolonging or elongating the matter, trying to solve it through a kind of political solution, ultimately, because the Lebanese government doesn't want a civil war and considers that a threat to the stability of the country. So if there is a will in confronting, then it is possible to get that kind of material support, for example, from liberation states. Like, theoretically speaking, that is possible. But what is important is the decision from someone like Joseph Aoun to ask the Lebanese government to face those threats. It means that there is an alternative choice, and that the Arab direction by nature is one that diplomacy needs to be based on willingness to stop the Israeli aggression. I think that's been established. Otherwise, what you say is correct. If relying on American weapons and American decisions, then in that case, the Lebanese government will not fight, because the Americans are a part and parcel of this whole strategy, and Israel cannot do what it's doing without them. So I don't know, and it's not clear that America is right now on board with the full-scale aggressions of the Israeli occupation entity and this becoming a full-scale war. And I don't believe that Aoun would be able to say what he said or make the threat that he made without the American green light. Of course, to be clear, America was the one that, you know, for the past 2 years has given Netanyahu the free hand to do whatever he wants. You know, if Israel reached Beirut, it wouldn't have said no. But I think now there's something greater, and that is returning to a wider war is not favored after stopping the war with Gaza. So on that basis, I think it's unlikely for war to return to Lebanon in the full scale, since it seems that the phase right now is one of settlements between entering a war and the resistance in Lebanon emerging victorious and holding a lot of the areas in the south and in Lebanon, and for the situation to remain as it is with a government in charge. I mean, America wants Aoun and Salam in power. The Americans want a government, even if it's not 100% in control. It wants coexistence between the two. The American establishment's position is different from that before the ceasefire. Prior, Israel, yes, had the free hand, prove that you are capable of establishing a quote-unquote new Middle East. But now America doesn't want a big escalation. It will be limited, I believe, without full collapse. But I'd also just add that the statement from Aoun also means that the regional direction is saying to the Israeli occupation entity, enough is enough. And this vindicates the position of the resistance that are willing to deal with the government to face the threat of aggression and to advance sovereignty. And this is coming at a time when we've just seen today the head of the Egyptian intelligence in Lebanon. And it's proof that ultimately the Arab national security is threatened, feels threatened, like Egypt feels threatened by Israel's expansionist agenda from the Nile to the Euphrates. And it seems that the Arabic stance is in this direction, which I believe could even reduce the rate of the normalization effects and its efforts as well.
Interesting point. Ali, we look at the so-called Minister of Defense of Israel, Yisroel Katz, and he's criticized the Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, for allowing his army to protect the liberated regions of the south. I mean, your thoughts on the gall, basically, that an enemy state or entity is telling a sovereign country that its army is not allowed to protect its people. I mean, it's so mind-boggling. And, of course, we see the lack of so-called international reaction to all of this.
That shouldn't come as a surprise, particularly from this Israeli government, which has shown a blatant disregard for the sovereignty of countries, and it's pursuing an expansionist agenda. Of course, at the same time, and I think as your guest mentioned, it enjoys full American backing with all of these moves or these steps it's taking. My colleague did raise an interesting point about President Aoun when he said that any future Israeli incursions into Lebanese territory will be met by action from the Lebanese army. I think it's quite possible that that stance was not taken without the Americans being pre-informed, meaning that President Aoun, it's likely that he didn't make the statement without the Americans knowing of that beforehand. Now, I think that was a smart move on behalf of President Aoun, because the Lebanese army is one of America's allies. It's supplied by America, military equipment from the United States. It's considered to be one of the region's militaries that is close to the United States. So to have the Lebanese military enter a confrontation with the Israeli military, that is not good at all for American interests. So it was a smart move, and I think this is why you haven't seen any future or any more, sorry, Israeli incursions in Lebanese territory, because that puts the Trump administration in kind of a difficult position. So it was, again, a wise move on behalf of the president. Let's wait and see. The guest also mentioned the Egyptian initiative, which is also interesting, the way Egypt is enhancing and broadening its role in the region. Was that also coordinated with the Americans? In my humble opinion, also it's likely that it was. And this brings me to another reason as to why we shouldn't jump to conclusions about war being somehow inevitable, because you do have American regional partners who are getting involved. And when I say partners, Egypt is one of them. We all know that the Egyptians have a close alliance with the U.S. as well. So I think these are all important factors which we have to keep an eye on.
Okay, well, Batul, let's look at what Ali has just said, because he feels that basically, as you've just heard, that whether we're talking about the Egyptian side of things, other parts of it is basically being managed by Washington. I mean, your thoughts, then, when we look at what we're dealing with, we not only do not have condemnations from the guarantors of the ceasefire agreement, but we see added threats from the Americans and encouragement from the French about disarming Hezbollah. So your thoughts on this. Would you say that the goals of the guarantors and the Israeli regime are basically the same, or like Ali, you feel that it is different, that because it just seems like both sides want to protect the Zionist entity and weaken its enemies?
Because the Israeli occupation entity is primarily it's the Western project for, I would say, not just the whole region, but ultimately it is the core capitalist headquarters of capitalism for the past century as we know it. So, of course, the American role is to give Israel what it needs to basically finish the job, as they put it forward. Like, let's not forget that, you know, it was Trump that came forward and said that Israel is so thin that it needs thickening up. And, you know, that was like the plan A. It's like, see, let's see what you're made of. Let's see where you can expand into. But as I mentioned in the first question, the conclusion of all of that is incapacity and incapability. So we know Israel has the goal of expansion and creating, this quote-unquote new Middle East, and America and the West have their goal of controlling the important region so their hegemony can be realized. What happens if this is met with failure, and that has been the result of the past 2 years, is the inability to achieve these goals. Right. So as my colleague has mentioned, of course, in that situation, then what could not have been achieved militarily cannot be achieved politically. And so therefore, the West will have to reassess the situation and the strategy moving forward in the region. And I believe the regional situation as a whole is moving towards finding political solutions across all fronts, depending on the outcomes and consequences of this recent war. And there are many parties involved in this process. You have the Arab states feel that their national security is threatened as a result of the war. So they may see the presence of resistance movements as actually necessary for safeguarding Arab national security. The Arab sides prefer political settlements whilst maintaining the existence of the resistance, even if these settlements do not call for its dissolution. So just to be clear, the ambition of the Israeli entity for a greater Israel and a new Middle East was so blatant that even for the Arab regimes, that has become somewhat unacceptable. And the Palestinian and the Lebanese resistance movements, along with others, have been a key factor in thwarting that project. So when the Egyptian intelligence chief Hassan Rashad came to Lebanon, his mission was to seek settlements based on withdrawal, prisoner exchange, reconstruction, yet the Israeli entity openly declares that it's not interested in such matters.
Well, Ali, Hezbollah Secretary General Naim Qassem says that Hezbollah will never give up the resistance and give up resisting this entity as long as the countries being threatened. Your thoughts on the role of Hezbollah at this point in time, and will it allow itself to be disarmed, or just tell me what you think on that side of things.
Hezbollah will never disarm under the current circumstances, and there are many factors behind that. First and foremost, you have Israel under the most fascist right-wing government ever since Israel's founding. We know the expansionist ambitions of this government, which includes Lebanese territory, by the way. So that's one factor. Another factor is that the Lebanese army doesn't have the military capabilities to face Israel as a peer-to-peer military force. And you also have another factor. Let's be honest, the Shia population in Lebanon has borne the brunt of Israeli aggressions, whether in South Lebanon or in the Bekaa region. So even from a popular perspective, the Shia population would be completely against Hezbollah's disarmament and will view that as a big act of betrayal, even if we were to assume for the sake of argument that Hezbollah's leadership was inclined to take such a decision. So with all that in mind, I don't think that the discussion of Hezbollah disarming is realistic in any way whatsoever.
Well let me just jump in here. What you've just said, wouldn't the United States know this, what you've just said, that Hezbollah will never allow itself to be disarmed in this situation? So why do we see this constant pressure being put on the Lebanese government from the United States?
I think that they view that now it's an opportunity of the lifetime, meaning that Hezbollah was dealt some very severe blows during the previous war, the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the operations which took place. So they view that it's now or never. Now it's the golden opportunity to deal Hezbollah the knockout blow. That's why you have the insistence. And also another factor which we haven't mentioned is the confrontation with Iran. The United States views Hezbollah, the disarmament of Hezbollah, as part of a wider confrontation with Iran. It views that by disarming Hezbollah, it can then further weaken Iran's position. So that's why it continues to intensify these efforts, even if that appears to be unrealistic, given the factors which I mentioned before about Israeli ambitions, also about the regime in Syria. We have the Salafi jihadis who also view Hezbollah ideologically as an ideological enemy. But the United States, as I said, and Israel, they see that it's a golden opportunity now or never. This is going to weaken Iran, etc. So it's about all of those issues. That goes, I think, or that explains why we have this American and Israeli insistence on the disarmament of Hezbollah.
All right, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Ali Riz, security and political analyst out of Beirut, Batu Sobeidi, activist and political analyst out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Peer pressure. Yes, dear teens, we know you are not always surrounded by positive people, good people, or sometimes come under pressure. And we are here to help you through how you can go with these scenarios. Well, in the previous episode, we reached the conclusion that on that day, people will be crying from the hellfire. Woe to me, I wish I didn't choose this and this particular person as my Khalil, as my friend. So be careful in choosing friends and be careful coming under this pressure because the consequences are very, very bad. And whenever you choose to do something, look at the consequences first. That's just off the previous episode. And we'll continue with the same. Brother Liaqat, again, the stage is all yours.
So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, when it is said about the verse of the Holy Quran, where a person is going to say, grief be upon me. So he will wish for grief on that day. And the grief is because of choosing so-and-so person and a few friends, example, as a friend in when he was alive in this world or she was alive in this world. So, you know, if we, as parents or educators, example, we it's a kind of responsibility. I would say it's a wajib responsibility to teach our children, to teach our teens especially, because now that they're going to become baligh, example, or they have passed the stage of bulugh,
right.
They are matured now, and they know what feelings are, example, and they can really distinguish between genders now, and they know what are inclinations and everything, right? So, so example, when we tell them about smoking, okay, as parents or educators, when we tell them, you know what, smoking is not allowed, okay? It's really something which I don't accept it to happen. Likewise, I don't accept drinking. Likewise, it's not just me, it's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's the Ahlul Bayt, it's the Holy Quran. So if you are drinking, example, you're going against everything. It's haram. The concept of haram should be introduced before itself.
Mm-hmm.
Example, the concept of haram should be introduced, I would say, from the childhood itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is haram? What is not allowed? And example, it should be taught to the child in a manner that, you know what, this is something bad. And you know, you are such a good person and you don't like it. You don't like it. You know how it is the law of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam. We say the child, you know, the Ahlul Bayt are very good. They are, mm-hmm. they are very nice.
Noble,
and they are from Allah.
Kind,
you see,
yeah.
We love them. Likewise, how we are teaching love of Ahlul Bayt to our kids, love of the Holy Quran to our kids. Likewise, we teach what is not allowed as well. You know, alcohol is very bad. Those people are very bad example, you see. And we shouldn't be going to those kind of people, and we shouldn't be listening if someone tells us to, example, go towards it and drink it, example,
thing,
you see.
Yeah.
So when a person gets a list of what a haram, example, and what a haram in today's world are really astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they are like updated.
Right.
Back in our days, example, like when we were children, this internet and this kind of technology was not available.
Yes.
In those days, like haram was something else. Okay. It was kind of fantasy. Maybe if a person has to go and commit something haram. But in today's world, haram is very easy to be committed. Example, you see?
Right. Yeah. We'll discuss more on that. Let's take a short break here.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsin. سينين وخالقنا وراسقنا وهو على كل
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Yaqut, you said a very important point before going to the break. You said that in today's world, access to haram is so available. It's so out there. And in, like, for example, back in our days, it was a fantasy. The things that those were fantasies. Our teens today are living those fantasies, actually, and it's really hard to hold back. So, yeah, we would want you to give us some strategies so that our teens do not come under this peer pressure. For example, they live in good families, they come from good families, but still the peer pressure is something that sometimes drags you.
Yeah, as parents or educators, example, if we teach them to have patience, just like we teach them to have patience in hardship, if we teach them to have patience if there is a sin in front of us, example, then that will really help us. Just like, you know, of course, even if we don't use the word patience, okay, if we are just saying you have to get rid of it, you can't go towards it, okay, if we are saying in this manner, it means that, okay, I should be having patience if something is put forward in front of me, like, which is a sin.
Right,
okay?
Right.
So, of course, there are different stages and there are different levels of patience according to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. One of them is patience when we are confronted with a sin.
When you have all the grounds
to commit a sin and you still don't want to commit it and you are not committing it. And also patience in obligatory acts, example, patience in hardships.
Well, a human is a kind of like he gets tempted, and you know we are made in a way that we get tempted easily.
Yes.
But it's like even if your heart wants, even if you feel like okay, maybe this will give me some kind of pleasure for some time, I'll get some kind of entertainment for some time, and I don't know, just get out of stress or other things, but. When you say to yourself, okay, calm down on this, and that's actually what we call as patience and sins.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? This thing, example, is very important to be put forward in the beginning stage itself. Example, you know, the pressure comes on a teen, okay, for a particular sin, and the sin is not yet tasted by this particular teen, okay? If he or she has already tasted, the tendency to commit the sin or to go under pressure increases. Is a lot, yeah? But example, if the teen has never ever drank alcohol, I'm just giving a simple example, then the teen might say, I don't want to drink it at all. Why? Because the upbringing has happened in such a manner. You know what? The parents or the educators are like, you know what? Alcohol is haram. You can't drink even a drop of it. You can't even taste it. Tasting a drop of alcohol is also haram. Likewise, if we put forward in this manner, if we put forward in front of our teens all the examples, example, the group of people or the group of teens or group of classmates tell something to be searched on website, on social media, which is not allowed according to Islam. If the educator or the parents know this thing and like before itself, they create grounds in order that the teen knows the boundaries. So if we don't train our kids or if we don't do upbringing in such a manner, the teen doesn't know whether this is halal or haram even. He gets pressurized, he commits something.
Maybe I'm getting
into dark. And he
gets
that kind of I would say, desire to commit it once again.
Right.
So it's our responsibility to draw that line before itself.
Right.
So that the teen is not pressurized and is not going to go in that manner.
Right. We'll take a short break and we'll be back in a while.
Ya muqdi al khayra. يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Yaqut Abbas is with us. He is telling us the strategies to overcome peer pressure. Yes.
Yes, sister. So another example, what happens is a student is pressurized by peers or classmates to cheat on a test. So with friends insisting that everyone is doing it. So they're going to say, oh, you know what? Only you are not
participating in the cheating.
Yeah, exactly. You're not showing your answers. Everyone else are sharing their answers in this in the examination, in the examination hall. And it's just one time thing. Like, just show it for once. Like, it's just for today. I'm not going to ask you anymore. You see, I'm not going to bother you in the next exam because I know it beforehand. It's, for example, it's an easy subject. Yeah. But you know, when it comes to that day, again, it's the same thing going on. Again, it's the same cassette or recorder which says, oh, you know what? It's just for today. Show your answers only for today, only for this exam. I promise you, I'm not going to ask. So this is a kind of pressure, again, which is built upon a teen, you see, or a child even. So one thing which we have to, or the student has to remind himself or herself, is about the importance of honesty over here. Number one, importance of honesty. How honest are we towards our examination? And on the other hand, let me tell you very fairly and very frankly, and that is, copying, cheating in examination is haram, according to the fatwa or according to the rules of Maharaj in Islam, example. Yep. Copying, cheating, showing answers, copying answers, looking at answers, copying them on an answer sheet is haram.
Haram.
Simple.
Act.
Yeah. Be it on an academic level, be it on an Islamic level, be it on whatever level. So copying is haram in examination. So being fair is very important.
Yes.
So, you know, the boundaries are laid by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala over here. Okay?
Yes.
So if someone is asking us to cross those boundaries, of course, our intellect will say no. Simple no. Okay, I don't know the answer. So let me be honest with myself. I have to accept the truth that I'm going to get less marks. Or even if I'm going to fail, I have to accept it. Why? Because I didn't learn properly. I didn't train myself in such a manner that I can write answers in a good manner, you see. So I have to be honest, and honesty is very important. And you know what? Honesty is something which should be taught by our parents, which should be taught by our educators. It's okay. Be honest to yourself. Even if you fail in your
exam.
Even
if the consequences are not good.
It's okay. Yeah. At least you are not going to end up in the consequences of the hereafter.
Right.
If you cheat, you're going to get sin and stuff. At least you're not going to go into that extent.
Right.
You're going to just lose few marks. That's it. You see?
Yeah.
So if we
are honest. The consequences are going to be small.
Very small. Right. And you know, even the parents are going to be like, okay, next time work hard. Like, this time it's okay, but next time, and they're more keen to upon their teen that they progress even more and not fail in the next exam. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. That was all the time we had for today. Dear teens, remember, Surah Zalzal says, we will be rewarded or punished for the acts which are even of the atom size. So be aware of your actions, and be that through pressure or be that any action, be aware of your actions. Thank you for listening. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli ala Fatimata wa Abiha wa ba'alaha wa baniha بالسر المستودع فيها بعدد ما أحاط به الملك. We send our deepest devotion and deepest condolences to our beloved Imam of Time on the days of the commemoration and remembrance and the revival of the remembrance of the Shahada and the martyrdom of the Lady of Light, the mother of all the Imams, Lady Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayha, who was the dearest to the Holy Prophet, to the extent that the Holy Prophet said, Al-Fatimatu bada'atun minni. Fatima is a limb, is a part of me, is a part of my body, is a part of my heart. She's the apple of my eyes. She's so dear to me. If someone bothers her, indeed has bothered me, that's how dear Lady Fatima al-Zahra Salamullah alayha was to the Holy Prophet and indeed to all the Imams, the mother who became Shaheed and martyr and taught her offspring to become martyrs, like they learnt it from their mother. May Allah allow us to truly discover the greatness of our beloved mother, Lady of Light, Lady Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayha, and to be able to implement her teachings into our lives. One of her teachings is the teaching of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in the book Sahifa al-Sajjadiyah, the 19th dua, the supplication number 19th, when he was asking water in the time of, in asking for water during a drought, which is the title of the 19th dua. We got to the fifth phrase that says, Allahumma asqana saqiyan tusilu minhu darab. O Lord, O Allah, send down upon us a rain that causes the mountains to flow with water. Wa tamlau minhu al-jabab, and that fills the wells and the underground channels and canals. Wa tufajjaru bihi al-anhar, and that makes the rivers gush forth. And the one that grows the trees by its grace, that through its blessing lowers prices and brings about affordability, and thereby grants comfort to the livestock, and indeed to all creation. Through this rain, may pure sustenance reach everyone in sufficiency, and may the crops grow well. May the milk of the flocks flow abundantly, and through this, may you increase our strength upon our strength. Let's take a quick break and stay tuned with us.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana.
What Imam alayhi salam is mentioning in this portion of the dua, as we talked about it, the very first part of this fifth phrase of the 19th dua in the previous session, is that Imam is mentioning the importance or highlighting the importance of a balanced economical system, which is the foundation or which makes the foundation of social power. I mean, a very important point in this passage or in this phrase is the reference to social power that arises from a balanced economical system, which will be a rational, calculated, and lasting power. And this is in stark contrast to power derived from oppression and the violation of the rights of others, which is going to be unstable and not permanent, right? It's breakable, it's fragile, inherently unstable. If such power is accompanied by suppressed grievances and social frustrations, it'll certainly turn into a destructive and harmful force. Although its damage may not be repairable in the short term, it will ultimately lack stable foundations rooted in truth and rationality. However, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam again emphasizes and makes this bold, that power based on the principles of justice and truth under wise and logical supervision always brings about prosperity, it brings about peace, it brings about well-being, and poses no threat to any other group or party. And another point that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam points out or mentions and highlights in this portion of the dua is the part that he says, وَتَزِيدُنَا بِهِ قُوَّةً إِلَىٰ قُوَّتِنَا. By this bringing, by this creating balance in the economical system where things are at the place they belong to, by that increase our power, right? That means balance increases our power. Balance increases our strength. Let's take another break and we'll be back quickly.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
Our respected brothers and sisters, Imam, not only Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, not only asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for power, but also request a strength for his nation, the nation of Islam, that surpasses other powers, stating that you increase our strength upon our strength. تَزِيدُ قُوَّةً إِلَىٰ قُوَّتِنَا. Naturally, an Islamic wise system, right, in the system and infrastructure created by Islam, everything, be it financial or military power, is defined and regulated in a state of perfect balance and equilibrium. This sacred religion, this beautiful blessing, Islam, was revealed to the noble Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam for the guidance of humanity. And the philosophy of this sublime faith does not include power mongering or the accumulation of wealth. Rather, the struggle against the negative aspects of power displayed and hoarding wealth is one of its primary directives. Therefore, the Holy Quran identifies oppression, arrogance, excessive demands, accumulation of wealth as the most hateful of deeds, is what Quran talks about and highlights it. This is a slogan that Quran has. Say, my Lord has commanded justice. قُلْ أَمَرَ رَبِّي بِالْقِسْطِ is the hallmark of, is the highlight of the Holy Quran's social philosophy. And for this reason, the superior economic system of the final religion is built upon intellect and reason and balance. Rain can help that. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم، عشق و تولای تو را
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Vaghefi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة